Brooke. It's August, and we're coming up on 2 full years of doing this show together, which is just amazing. And it's also stunning to me how much has changed in our world since last August, because I went back and listened to our August episodes in 2019 when the world was, I don't know, rosier, better. And I was talking about Jules' final year of high school, and you were getting ready to go to Jordan. And this year I have kids stuck at home with distance learning, and there's no international travel happening on your end, I don't believe.
Oh, definitely not happening. And yeah, it has been surreal to watch all the things pass by in my calendar, all the plans I had made, which did include a trip to Italy, which is actually where I would be right now if things were normal. And yet anyone I talk to who's mourning the loss of vacation basically follows with the statement, you know, some qualifier about how lucky we are to be healthy and that it feels weird to talk about the loss of a trip when so many people are suffering. And I have said to people and myself included, that I think it's okay to hold all of the disappointments because the losses of things like retreats and trips and family reunions are also big losses, even if they're not in the same category of loss as losing someone you love, of course.
Yeah, there's definitely a continuum of loss and we're all experiencing grief on a lot of levels these days. So it's, I guess it's what good to feel that your loss isn't illegitimate just because it's not as big or as drastic as it could be.
Right. And since ours is a show about inspiration, which, you know, we mostly do a good job of holding to, we're going to try to keep our listeners inspired through August by highlighting some of our favorite episodes of the past year.
Yeah, and we've chosen to do this by genre. So we're highlighting 3 genres, science fiction, then memoir, then YA, running this week and the next 2 weeks. And we're starting with Veronica Roth and Cory Doctorow. I wanted to start with them because each of them write dystopian fantasy novels, and they each talked about how their approach to dystopian fiction grew out of present world conditions and served to comment on it. I think there are many purposes of stories, but one of the most basic purposes since the beginnings of time is to alert others to what to fear in the world. And we've certainly continued that storytelling purpose with dystopian novels, which are more important than ever, whether they're about climate change, authoritarian rule, pandemics, or all the above. And I want to say that ironically, Cory's book Radicalized had just come out when we interviewed him a little over a year ago. And I remember reading this statement, dystopia is now, on the back cover. And I'm thinking how ironic and prescient that is.
Yeah. And at the time, we were thinking about dystopia in a really different way, I think, than we are thinking about it now. And both of those were such interesting interviews. And in fact, talking to Veronica led me to read the first book in her Divergent series. I knew who she was, of course, but I had never read any of her work. And only because sci-fi and fantasy both really aren't on my radar as much as I would like them to be. This is dystopian fiction, as you said, which I think is almost a subgenre all its own. It was interesting to see that a lot of reviewers didn't like Veronica's 5 factions when Divergent first came out, and she got a lot of flack for it. So I read a lot of negative reviews about this system that she created that classifies citizens based on aptitude and values. And then people have to decide when they're teenagers, which faction they want to align themselves with forever, right? But, you know, now she too seems pretty prescient because so much of the recent division in our country is absolutely around aptitude and values, however you might want to perceive that. You know, people on both sides of the political spectrum are attacking one another for their values and belief systems. And there's so much division and classification going on. So reading it through today's lens, I was like, yeah, this is pretty psychologically astute. And I definitely enjoyed it for that reason. Grant, are there any dystopian novels you've read this year that you'd recommend?
Yeah, I actually read a couple. Wittgenstein's Mistress is about a woman literally wandering around the world alone, the sole survivor. And as a reader, you're not sure if she's insane or if she's actually the last person alive on the planet, but it doesn't matter because she offers the, you know, this hypnotic meditation on her life. So it really becomes a meditation on loneliness and being separated from life's normal pleasures, and which is certainly pertinent today. And that was a good bridge to Station 11, which so many people were referring referring to when this pandemic started. It's a novel by Emily St. John Mandel, and it takes place in the Great Lakes region after a swine flu pandemic has devastated the world, killing most of the population. And so most of the book, or a great deal of the book, takes place 20 years later, and the main character moves between settlements of the altered world with a small troupe of performers dedicated to keeping art and humanity alive. And it's interesting to me because they move back and forth in time between before and after the pandemic. So it's interesting to think about our present world and imagine what the world might look like on the other side of this pandemic. I hope we won't be roaming the earth in packs trying to save art and culture, Brooke. I hope we'll still be podcasting about art and culture.
God, me too, Grant. Now that we're in this dystopian frame of mind, let's listen to these two fantastic authors talk about why they take on dystopian themes in their work and so much more.
Here goes, starting with Veronica Roth. I'm super excited to welcome our guest today, Veronica Roth. Veronica is the number one New York Times bestselling author of the Divergent series, which includes Divergent, Insurgent, Allegiant, and Four, a Divergent collection. The Carve the Mark duology, Carve the Mark, The Fates Divide, The End and Other Beginnings collection of short fiction, and most recently, Chosen Ones, which just came out. Welcome, Veronica.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Veronica, you wrote one of my favorite NaNoWriMo pep talks of all time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I happened to go back and read it in preparation for this episode. And I love it because you spoke to something I think a lot of writers have a hard time doing, which is letting go of their process. And I'm going to read you a short quote from your pep talk just to remind you of it.
Great.
You wrote, "When you reach the place on Manuscript Mountain that makes you consider admitting defeat, and the tools you've used to get as far as you have are no longer working for you, consider using someone else's tools. Pantser, try plotting. Plotter, try literally burning your outline, safely in a trash can or something. Perfectionist, try writing the worst scene you can possibly muster. Strict beginning to ender, write whatever scene is burning a hole in your brain and fill in the gaps later." So I'm curious if you can tell us a little bit about your process and have you actually let go in such a way?
So when I talk to teenagers, which happens often, I tell them that my process is desperation. So no book has ever been the same as any other book for me. And I do interviews like this every so often, and people always ask, like, oh, what do you do every day? Like, what's your schedule, like, what's your plan? What's your process? And I'm like, I just cannot answer that question because it will change when I write my next book. So I think I've really let go. I'm on the other side. I'm in the weird, dark place where there's no process.
You know, Veronica, just touching on this a bit more. I read somewhere, I believe, where, you know, you kind of presented as an overnight success story that seems like very dramatic, but I read that you'd been writing since you were 12 and writing pretty diligently. So there was like a training ground for you.
Yeah. I mean, there are no overnight success stories, really. I feel like it just seems that way because people become aware of you at a particular point. But yeah, I started writing almost daily when I was 11 or 12 years old. And I continued, I think, up until college when I ran out of energy to do that. And even then, I was still writing regularly, just not every day, you know.
Yeah.
And I was obsessed with it. Like, my mom was worried about my social development in high school. She's like, can you please go have some fun? I was like, no, I refuse.
Well, and it's funny because you're writing on these topics of dystopian fiction. It might lend itself to seemingly antisocial behavior. And we've done a few interesting shows on the topic of dystopian fiction and its popularity and what are quickly becoming dystopian times. And when we talked to Cory Doctorow, he said that dystopian fiction was a type of invitation and an opportunity to think about re-envisioning our relationship to the planet or to come together collectively to solve big collective problems. So why do you write dystopian fiction and what purpose do you see it having?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should talk about Cory Doctorow because one of my most significant author moments is listening to him talk. I was on a panel with him a couple years ago, and I swear this is related, but he said, for people who get alarmed by dystopian fiction, I think was the context of what we were talking about. He said that if you're alarmed by technology, if you're alarmed by the way things are going, remember that there are innovators out there who are trying to rise to meet those challenges, and they are innovating just as like our foes are innovating. And so don't be too discouraged, because for every dark thing that happens, there is a light thing trying to meet it. And that was really an important thing for me to hear articulated, because that's kind of what I tell people about dystopian fiction, which is that these are stories that could seem a little grim, and certainly parents are concerned that their children are really into dystopian fiction. But I always tell them, don't be worried, because what they're actually reading are stories about people being active in fighting the things that they think are bad in the world, who are claiming agency over their situations and learning how to kind of band together and make friends and do something. So I don't see a real problem with that. And I think it's especially good for young people. So I'm really glad young people got into dystopian fiction when they did.
That's a great definition and a great empowerment message as well. You know, you've moved beyond YA fantasy with your recent debut in adult fantasy with Chosen One.
Yeah.
And I like that this novel deals with what happens after those chosen to save the world actually do it. I think that's really fascinating. And I'm curious, what's different about writing in a different category, and how are the themes in this novel more adult than YA, or are they?
Well, I think they are. That's kind of why I knew this book was for adults. So I didn't approach it in any different way other than that at a conceptual level, it did not feel like young adult fiction to me. So young adult fiction is usually about coming of age and figuring out who you are. But this book, Chosen Ones, is about dealing with what you've done and the repercussions of it. And how do you enter a world when you've been preparing for something your entire life and you accomplished it, congratulations, but now what? And now what is not really a young person's question. It is definitely in your 20s kind of question, if not later. And even though, you know, none of us have saved the world, presumably, everyone knows what it's like to prepare for something and then to reach it and then have to deal with whatever comes after. Like, you spend your entire life going to school just to get a job, and then what, you know? And so I think that's kind of the relatable part of Chosen Ones, is that when you're at the top of the mountain, you still have to climb back down the mountain or find some other mountain. So really, that my approach to Chosen Ones was different in that it just was a different kind of theme, a different kind of character struggle. And otherwise, I just tried to do a good job and be thoughtful about it the same way I would with a YA book.
Veronica, fantasy authors are often viewed mainly through the lens of fantasy and other worlds. And I was interested to learn about how Chicago holds a place in your imagination and has a place in your world building process, too. So you used Chicago buildings as inspiration in Chosen Ones, and Chicago winters played a role in Carve the Mark. So I'm wondering if you could tell us more about your world building process and how you integrate real world things or places like Chicago into your work.
Well, I have never incorporated as many real world things as I did in Chosen Ones. There's so much research involved in this book. I'm not sure why I fixate on Chicago other than that I live here. And when you live in a place, you know how it feels to walk down the street, to look around. And there's something nice about rediscovering those things as you write, because you can set a book anywhere. You can do research about anything. I mean, Google Earth alone will help you to figure out how things look and how they work. But when you live in a place that you're writing about, you get to encounter it as if for the first time. So writing kind of defamiliarizes you with it, and you have to do research on things you thought you already knew about. So I have fallen in love with Chicago over and over again by writing about it. And there's just no reason not to keep doing it.
That's funny. Well, sometimes readers think authors have, you know, writing craft entirely figured out, whereas in reality, most authors I have spoken to, they're keenly aware of both their strengths and their weaknesses. I'm curious, what craft elements do you think are your strong suit, and what would you like to be better at?
Well, I think my strengths are in character and emotion. So I don't find those to require quite as many edits usually as other things. But I'm trying to think of, I'm trying to pick one of the things that I want to work on. In recent years, I've had to really work on my antagonists. In Divergent, my antagonist characters were all a little bit one-sided, a little bit Disney villain, and I've tried to add more depth and complexity to them. And then I also have trouble sometimes with practical aspects of world building, like just how technology would work in a world like Chosen Ones where there's magic, or, you know, what kind of businesses would exist and how would they relate to social media and would they have it? And all those kind of like greater concerns were really difficult for me to make decisions about. And I luckily have an editor, John Joseph Adams, who is just incredibly good at that stuff. So he sent me an editorial letter with like 10 pages of questions about how things in the world worked that I hadn't made any decisions about. So he helps with that. Yeah. I think sometimes I reach for the easiest explanations and the easiest ideas. And what I really need to do is discard my first inclination and go for something harder when I revise, for sure.
That's good advice.
Exactly. Well, in closing, if you could tell a writer starting their first novel one bit of advice, what would it be?
Wow. Okay. Well, I think what's important is to balance humility with a kind of arrogance, which sounds odd, but every writer has a little bit of arrogance because they believe that they have something to say that the world needs to hear, and only they can say that thing. And you have to hold on to that. Otherwise, you'll never be able to write anything. So you need to have the ability to fight for yourself and to believe in yourself and trust your instincts. However, that does not mean that you should be full of yourself or incapable of taking criticism. So you can't become defensive whenever people criticize you. You have to hear the flaws in your own work and see them as opportunities instead of an assault against your person. And so entering the writing world with humility is really important for a young writer. Like, everyone is trying to help you, even if sometimes they don't do it in the nicest way. So take the good, let go of the things that don't resonate with you, and remember to fight for yourself.
Brooke, one thing I like about our sponsor, Book Pipeline, is that they offer a path, or a pipeline, you might say, to publication and beyond publication. I hear they have a new competition brewing now, in fact.
You heard right. The Book Pipeline's adaptation competition seeks published books, graphic novels, short stories, and plays for film and television adaptation. And they're awarding $10,000 and connecting the winner with production companies. And then they're offering $2,000 to two runners up. So that's $1,000 each.
That sounds good, Brooke. I also heard that there are no genre restrictions, and judging criteria is weighed evenly between concept originality, marketability, and overall writing talent.
You've got a good source, Grant.
Yes, my source also tells me that pipeline development execs can assist the winning writer in adapting the work themselves into a script. And here's something really special. All entrants receive general feedback on the adaptability potential of their story. But my source didn't know the deadline for this.
Aha. Well, my source told me the deadline is August 15th. So that is this week.
Coming up soon. Did your source tell you how to submit by carrier pigeon?
It's a little easier than that. You can actually just go to bookpipeline.com. And if you look at the menu item, there is a specific button you can push for the adaptation contest. So we recommend that you go over there and check it out. There is an entry fee, so make sure to see if it feels right for you. And we wish you luck. And here are the highlights from our interview with Cory Doctorow.
I'm thrilled to have Cory Doctorow with us today because he's the kind of author who isn't just an author. He's a science fiction novelist, a blogger, a technology activist, and much more. His most recent books include the recently released sci-fi books Radicalized and Walk Away, In Real Life, a graphic novel, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, a book about earning a living in the internet age, and Homeland, a YA sequel to Little Brother. He is also the co-editor of the popular web blog Boing Boing and a special consultant to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit civil liberties group that defends freedom in technology law, policy, standards, and treaties. Thanks for joining us, Cory.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're going to talk about a lot of serious topics today, but to start on a light note, you and I have a similarity in our names. I've literally been asked thousands of times if I'm related to William Faulkner, and I'm guessing that you've often been asked if you're related to the author E.L. Doctorow, and I don't believe that you are, but I'm curious, have you ever just lied and claimed relation just for the fun of it?
No, I haven't done that, and you're right, I sometimes do get mistaken for that. In fact, I sometimes have had people say, well, that's easy for you to say, given how prominent your father is. and you know, I have to disabuse them. Doktorovich, it's one of those synthetic surnames that was given by the Russian tax collectors during the period of the Tsar to Ashkenazi Jews. Previously used patronymics, so-and-so, son of such-and-such, and those made it hard for record-keeping. And so both the Kaiser and the Tsar gave Ashkenazis these made-up last names, like Applebaum, if you're German, or Goldman, or Doktorovich, if you're Russian. And there are a lot of people called Doktorow, Doktorov, Doktorovich, Doktorov. And we are related in the sense that, like, Ashkenazis are all closely enough related, having passed through a bunch of genetic bottlenecks, that, like, if I were to marry someone of the same ethnic ancestry of my as me, we would have genetic tests before we had a baby, but not actually related in the sense that, like, we're you know, we attend the same family dinners when we were kids.
Yeah, I have a similar story. William Faulkner added the U to his name because he didn't want to be mistaken with his grandfather, who was also a writer. So it's very remote chance that I have any relation at all.
You guys have very distinguished authorly names, though, I have to say. So you have that going for you. And Corey, the theme of our show today is the radical author. And you're obviously an author who's writing fiction with political issues in mind. So could you tell us more about Radicalized, why you wrote it, and how it intersected with current events?
Yeah, Radicalized, it's my Trump derangement syndrome book. I wrote these four novellas while working on the third Little Brother novel, which I've also just turned in. And I wrote them because, like so many people in the 21st century, I'm getting, like, non-consensually eyeball banged by Trump headlines 24/7. And it's really hard to kind of understand the narrative. Like, is this a thing that I've already read about? Is this the being caused by that thing I read about yesterday, or is it separate from it? And so on. And so, you know, as a writer, what I do when I'm feeling anxious is I try to make narratives out of things. And that's how it came about. I wrote the first one, and my editor and the publisher at Tor really wanted to bring it out straight away, like as a novella that stood alone, you know, 2 months later. And I mentioned to them as we were going through the contracting for that I had another one I just finished. And they were like, oh, we'll do this one right away, you know, a month afterwards. And then, you know, as it became apparent that I had four of these on the go, they said, okay, we're going to treat this like a novel, and we're going to publish it like a, like, super current, news hook friendly novel. And we are going to treat this like a novelist, and we're going to pay you like it was a novel. We're going to send you out on tour. I just literally come back from the last leg of that tour, and so on. And so, you know, the stories, they cover four different themes, but they are super political. Like, the title story, Radicalized, is about entitled white dudes who live through the tragedy of the people they love best in the world dying horrible, lingering deaths because their insurers won't pay for their treatment, classing it as experimental. And instead of doing what white dudes usually do when they get really angry, which is to kill their intimate partners or shoot brown people in mosques, they go and they, on these underground message boards, where they are radicalized, and they become suicide bombers who kill healthcare executives and the senators who take their bribes. And it's a story that paints them in a pretty sympathetic light. So in that regard, it's pretty radical, but also does so as a form of political commentary to ask ourselves, who gets to be called a terrorist? Who's a lone wolf? Whose causes do we take up? And you know, whose excesses do we forgive? And whose do we condemn them for? And really, you know, I think every political movement, because rights are never given, they're only taken, every political movement has people who they rank as their allies or heroes who, in the cold light of historic distance, are reinvented as monsters. And, you know, contending with that is a really hard problem.
Yeah, Corey, the back cover text of Radicalized says, dystopia is now. And when I first read this, it certainly challenged my, I guess, my generally optimistic view. But my optimism is being challenged in so many different ways these days. So I've also begun to think more and more that maybe dystopia is beginning now instead of far off on the horizon where I like to think it could be. Do you believe that dystopia is now, or is it just good dramatic jacket copy?
Well, I didn't write that jacket copy, but I'll tell you, like, as a writer, I've already figured out what I want on my tombstone, and it's, this will all be so great if we don't screw it up. Right. And you know, that's how to understand whether dystopia is now or not. Like, we have, you know, in our moment that we're living through right now, we have the potential to completely revolutionize our view of humanity's relationship to its climate and environment, and also our shared destiny with one another, and to jettison 40 years of orthodoxy that says that all problems have individual causes and individual solutions and are just matters of individual agency, and instead re-envision ourselves as a species that is committed to collective action to solve big collective problems. And the answer to our incredible looming climate catastrophe is full, meaningful employment for every human being alive for the foreseeable future, remediating and retrofitting everything that needs to be done in order to remake our relationship with our planet so that it is sustainable and doesn't end up rendering us extinct. And, you know, if we can do that, like, that is the kind of heroic, amazing, meaningful thing that people, you know, write history books about. But if we don't, you know, our descendants are going to be digging through rubble with long sticks looking for canned goods and drinking their own urine, right? And so, you know, we get to choose, right? And in some really important way, we get to choose. We are at a crossroads. That's not something that a lot of people have had. You know, a lot of people have lived through some pretty inconsequential moments. And so we get to have a moment of consequence. And it could be terrible or wonderful, and we get to make up our minds.
Man, you're certainly tapping into a lot of the anxieties that I know I feel, and I'm sure a lot of other people feel. And when I think about the dystopian fiction that I grew up with, it didn't seem nearly as close to real life as it does now. I mean, certainly you're talking about this moment in time, which is a unique moment for all kinds of reasons. But back then, it felt like fantasy novels or something way off in the distant future. And now, as I'm saying, you know, it's kind of moving closer to reality. I'm wondering what kind of pressures that puts on you as an author. Does it enhance your imagination, or does it make you just tap into the issues that are at hand and the things, as you said, that make you anxious?
Well, it's a little of both, right? Because, you know, one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing is thinking about what shape a more sustainable future might take. Like, not like what its details will be, but what its rough outlines could be. And, you know, so my book Walkaway and you know, even the stories in Radicalized, which, you know, they're a mixed bag in terms of like happy and sad endings. And even the ones with pretty tragic endings, there's always, as Le Guin said, there's always a utopia buried in those dystopias. You know, there's a, one of the stories is The Mask of the Red Death, and it's about these preppers who are super rich and have been planning for the end of the world because they realize that most people in the world are basically useless, and they're destined to be replaced with machines, and they're not going to go gently. And so they'll rise up and try to eat their social betters. And so they've, you know, prepared these luxury bunkers to go and hide and be like bedwetting cowards in when everything breaks down. And you know, this turns out to end very badly for them. If you're familiar with the Poe story, Mask of the Red Death, you'll understand that you know, this is not a story that's going to have a happy ending. But, you know, the POV from which the ending is revealed is the POV of all the people that they've abandoned. And those are the people who are thriving. And so even though it's kind of it's a downer of a story, it's also got a hell of an upside. You know, I think that, like, there is plenty of room for optimism within anxiety, you know, and in particular, I think that it's not pessimistic to imagine a future in which things break down, right? Like, engineers who assume that things will never break down, that's not what we call optimism. It's what we call malpractice, or just, you know, idiocy, right? Like, that's the engineering choice that says, well, we probably won't need lifeboats on the Titanic because we know it won't sink, right? Assuming that things will break is optimistic if you also assume that you can fix them. And, you know, a lot of my stories are stories not just about things breaking, but about them being fixed afterwards.
I know you're a longtime activist, most notably for your work in liberalizing copyright laws, and you write nonfiction as well. Activists tend to write nonfiction, and it seems natural for you to funnel your thoughts and strong opinions into nonfiction. So how does fiction serve as a discussion of these issues in a way that nonfiction can't, and maybe vice versa?
Well, you know, I think nonfiction has to be accurate, while fiction can be true. And sometimes scrupulous attention to accuracy undermines your ability to get at the underlying truths, because it requires that you make leaps of faith. And so fiction can be like an architectural rendering of a potential future that you can fly through and get a sense of what maybe the lived emotional internal reality of that future would be like, which, you know, it takes these like very abstract policy discussions about, you know, for example, the first story in this book, it's called Unauthorized Bread. And it's about people in refugee housing where all the devices are designed to like take as much money as possible from them through their normal use. So the toaster will only toast bread that comes from a store that charges extra for bread, and the washing machine's only going to wash your authorized clothes. Then you have to shop at a store blessed by the company, and your dishwasher will only clean your authorized dishes, and so on. And you know, really, there's not any reason that that is more extreme than, say, a phone that will only run apps that come from one app store. And the Supreme Court just gave a go-ahead to a group of Apple customers to sue Apple over whether or not that's a monopolistic tactic that deprived them of their right to a competitive market. And, you know, we are increasingly living in a world where that app store model or even the inkjet printer model is being applied to other kinds of devices. You know, John Deere won't let you install your own parts in your tractor. You have to wait for a technician to come out and enter an unlock code before the part that you've installed yourself works, and you have to pay for that and wait for it. Johnson & Johnson got regulatory approval for an artificial pancreas that uses proprietary insulin cartridges, so you can't refill them with generic insulin. And so, you know, I can write nonfiction about the risks that arise from that, and I do, and it is significant, and it plays into policy debates. When we petition the Copyright Office every 3 years for exemptions to the rules that ban bypassing these locks, I do write a lot of nonfiction. But fiction also digs into some of the lived experience questions that even the most persuasive nonfiction struggles with, right? What does it feel like to have your technological self-determination taken away from you and replaced with an obligation to arrange your affairs to benefit the shareholders of some corporation? You know, that's a feeling thing as much as it is a thinking thing.
Well, Corey, in closing, since we're a show that really focuses on a lot of topics involved in the creative process, I'm curious what your advice would be. What advice would you give a beginning dystopian author? And I know also that you've got some opinions and perspectives on NaNoWriMo, so feel free to share those as well.
Yeah, I don't know that I have much advice for budding dystopians apart from, you know, distinguish between dystopian furniture and the dystopian premise, which is, you know, the dystopian premise is that no matter what we do, things are going to get worse, whereas dystopian furniture is what happens when you write about people fixing things after they break down. And, you know, dystopian furniture is a lot more interesting than, you know, the kind of boring, cynical dystopian premise. And in terms of writing, you know, the best advice that I got that I never listened to until years had gone by, and then I later wished that I had, was to write every day. And I had assumed that writing every day was the kind of thing you would do in a perfect universe, right? That it would be like, you know, doing an hour of aerobic exercise and getting five helpings of fresh fruits and vegetables and, you know, all those other things that, like, maybe if you had a PA and a nutritionist and whatever that you could manage, but that not anyone living a real busy life could ever hope to do. And it turns out that, like, if you write every day, writing becomes a habit, and habits are things that you get for free. And writing just starts happening automatically. And even if you're writing just a page a day, that's a novel every year. And it treats writing as a marathon and not a sprint. And the realizations that you need in order to accomplish this writing every day is to realize that although there are some days when the writing feels really, really good and feels like you're just on top of your game, and some days when it feels really, really bad and every word you can think of is totally unworthy, that you can't tell the difference in the moment. That, in fact, the way you feel about your work has a lot more to do with your blood sugar levels and how much sleep you got last night and how anxious you are about the world around you than any objective measure of the quality of your work itself. And so what that means is that your job in the moment is to write down some words, and then your job at some later moment is to figure out which ones were good and which ones were bad. And my cautionary note here is that when you really dig into this, you eventually realize that the good feeling you get from writing words that feel really good is probably not deserved either. That in fact, are not having good days or bad days when you write, you're just having days. And they're all much of a muchness. That the reason things are average is that they happen most of the time. And so you just have to kind of get used to that, right? You lose some of the heart-pounding joy, but you also lose that terrifying anxiety. And what you end up with is an almost mechanical daily exercise in which you put one brick on top of another until you turn around and you have a wall.
Thanks for tuning in during these dog days of August, everyone. We hope you're keeping in good spirits and not freaking out too much like I am about kids not really going back to school and the world looking like it may not, in fact, get back to normal anytime soon either. But I try not to get too dystopian. Our thoughts are with you, our listeners. And again, we're grateful you're out there. We will be back next week with our second mashup episode featuring Kiese Lehman and Jeanette Walls on memoir, not to be missed, Just Like Right Minded, which won't be missed if you download us into your feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks.